that's our subject, Neandra Tall Man. I like this redhead stuff there, you know. Finally, at last, after seven lessons, we're going to move into the flood stage after today's lesson. We're heading towards the end of our section here. We're going to be actually studying the period of time after the flood. But since the Neanderthal man is somewhat undefined as to when he lived, I just did it now because that'll settle that issue and it'll get that out of the way as we move into the flood period. So it's kind of a in-between lesson, like the last lesson we had was on civilizations. It's kind of that in-between. Was civilization before the flood or after the flood? We'll talk again about that a little bit. So our subject will be on the Neanderthal man. Ancient man or what? Last time we were together, we talked about this period of time. We established the possibility that there were pre-flood civilizations, and we may have looked at or they have discovered ruins of the same. And the question is, were not they all destroyed? Would they have not all been destroyed in the flood? Could have been. But also, some could have been left as a witness to the fact that the flood occurred. So we're going to leave it just kind of at that. So we have these questions. I keep pushing the wrong button now because they don't work. All right. So we just have these questions about this period of time. We can't be terribly emphatic about the civilizations. We probably can't be emphatic about the age of the people we will look at, whether the Neanderthals or whether they're just humans. We can't really tell for sure their age. So we say that just to let you know that this is probably a little inconclusive. But we know they're old. So our lesson today is similar to our civilization lesson because civilization presupposes men or man. If there was a civilization, there would have to be men. And we do know that there's evidence for these ancient civilizations and that, therefore, men did exist. But are they pre-flood or post-flood can be debated. And we have these civilizations, quite a few of them are immersed below the sea level water today, and they may be or may not be pre-flood. Remember we talked about this glacier melt issue. I wish I had a bigger arrow. Frustrates me. But this is what we had on the board the other day. Remember after the flood, this is now again after the flood, we had very warm seawater, maybe 100 degrees Fahrenheit, which is bath water almost. And it evaporated quickly like around the equator. This yellow arc is sort of like the latitudinal elevations of the globe as you go from the equator up to the pole. So at the equator, you'd have this warm water and it would evaporate into clouds, move to the polar regions where it would cool down. And when something cools down, it sweats or in atmosphere, it precipitates. And this precipitates out as snow. And then if the snow doesn't melt every cycle in the summertime, it starts to form glaciers. And this is not happening today. At any rate, and that's what our environmentalists are so worried about, that it's so warm in the atmosphere, these glaciers cannot form anymore, and they're melting, and therefore our sea levels are rising. And so that's a concern of theirs, thinking they can change that. But the process here in this glaciation period, accumulated water from the ocean, melted it and put it back in the ocean over probably hundreds of years, would have formed rivers like the Mississippi River, probably the Missouri River. I was looking for the degrees latitude down from, what do we have, 90 up to zero. And I found out that 45 is the Montana-Wyoming border. So between the equator and the North Pole, dead center, halfway is the Montana-Wyoming border. I found that out this last week because I was watching GPS and I was noticing it count down and also noticed it was 45 degrees, 59 minutes, and then the next one is feet. And it was counting down. Hey, we're getting close to the 45 degree point. And just within a few miles, we were there, and by lo and behold, it was the border. So I'll never forget that. So anyway, this is what happens, and this water melts, and then during these hundreds of years before the water, before the glacier melted, we had civilizations that apparently were built, at least in the scenario, were built on the what we call the continental shelf. And you see that off the off all our coastlines, and you have the shelf, and then it goes off deep into the deep ocean level. So this is the idea of the period of glaciation, and we think the Bible supports one, not many, which is what the evolutionists want to think, because there's never just a simple one catastrophe. There has to be a series of many things, and they become natural. I talked about glaciation, and I mentioned that, I think, here, and I wanted to confirm that it would be right, but John Morris says that if the earth would be smoothed out, that is, the oceans would be leveled up, and the mountains would be pushed down, there would be 8,000 feet of water on the earth. 8,000 feet, almost a mile and a half, or a mile and a half worth of water. And this water, a lot of it has come from these glaciers. You see, and I'm just showing the northern, I don't know why it happens more in the northern hemisphere than the southern hemisphere. I didn't research that, but it seems like it went, there were some down here in the south. You see the little white. These are glaciers, and I meant to say, I don't know how far south these glaciers came, but I think they came into Nebraska. I think they find marine life up there, and I'm not sure that came from the glaciers. I think that came from the flood, but they say it came from the glaciers because they don't accept the flood. So we're not sure exactly how far these come, but these glaciers did occur. They really did occur. I don't know how far north, south they came, because there's grooves in this Canadian region where you can see where these glaciers move through and cut these trenches. All right. This is, they say, the last glacier sea level rise. It's interesting how much it has risen. Now, they go back, these are thousands of years, so we can discount that. But the idea that the sea level have gone up probably is true. And the rate of sea level rise, we're not going to worry about that because we don't have the years here as they do. But the amount we can accept, 130 meters times 3.5 feet gives you about 422 feet of sea level rise. Now, that's quite a bit. You take the sea level down 420 feet around everywhere in the world, you're going to find a lot of exposed land. And that's where these civilizations were built. And then when the glaciers melted, then those sea levels came back over hundreds of years. I mean, otherwise, they wouldn't have built the civilizations on that ledge because they'd say, well, it's, you know, we're going to be inundated soon, so we can't do that. But they didn't perceive the time, and so they built the civilizations any time they were swamped. Okay, with all of this, now we have a fossil record. Sometimes we think there's a lot, but really there are not a lot of records, a lot of fossils. If you've seen fossils, you probably saw them in a museum. And if you lived out on a farm or someplace where you had access to the earth, I was going to say Mother Earth, I won't do that. But where you actually can, you know, gravel pits, rocks, perhaps you might have found some fossils. But generally people don't see them laying around. And 95% of these fossils are marine invertebrates, so they're not something you'd find laying around unless they came from the flood on this land. So most of them, 95% of them, are marine life invertebrates, clams, shells, things that don't have backbones. Then we have fossils that are algae and plant fossils, which are, I guess, algae are plants. So we take the next 4.75% of the 100%. It leaves a 0.25% left. Of that 0.25%, we have 2%, 25% of a point, a quarter of a point, includes insects and invertebrates. And then we have this less than 1%, 0.1% of the rest are vertebrates, mainly fish. 90% of the land vertebrate fossils consist of one bone fragment or tooth. An example, only about 1,200 dinosaur skeletons have been found as of 1994. So there's not a lot of these fossils around, as you might think, and yet there's enough. Human fossils. The human fossils are not as rare as evolutionary establishment suggests. According to Lubnow, the number of human fossils is much greater than is universally assumed. I've never seen a human fossil. I don't think. I've been in a museum. We've seen mummies, but that doesn't count. But fossils that are... I don't know what you call fossil. You go to the Hastings Museum. Remember, anybody been to the Hastings Museum? You see the pit of bones down there? I think those are relatively modern bones, I think, like from Indian time. But I've never seen a human fossil, I don't think. I can't remember. Didn't impress me if I did. So he catalogs these fossils of human hominids, and he gives a conservative tally, and he could have used the maximum values here. So he has 1,390 fossil individuals from Africa through 1976. 1,516 are from Europe, 1970 up to 1970, and 1,092 are from the Americas, Asia, and Australasia to 1974. So not a lot. These are human fossils now we're talking about, and you see one here. Extra. Now, you know, fossil parts are only fossil parts, and sometimes you can do a pretty good job with rebuilding an animal, but you can see in this situation how many fossils, pieces there are, and how much the animal they had to reconstruct. Now, I can't make a judgment as to how good they are at doing this. It would depend on if they found other fossils at other places to know what that animal looked like, that you could reconstruct it. But if you had no idea what this animal looked like, you'd have to go from your imagination. All right. So you have a pile of bones like this, and you could probably fit them together into something. This looks to me like a frog, not a human. Now, I told somebody the other day, he said, I wish Nebraska really was known for something. And then I remember, we are known for something. For the Nebraska man. A hoax, which forced a wrong conclusion. A tooth drawing in this Nature magazine remind me of this man is talking, this is a quote, of the Nebraska man, tooth drawing in the Illustrated London News in June 24, 1922. From a single tooth found in Nebraska, they reconstruct the entire body of Nebraska, of the Nebraska man and his wife, his lifestyle, his clothing, and his surroundings. Now, what was the word we used before again? Imagination. Later, they announced that it was a mistake. The tooth actually came from an extinct pig, as Dr. Gish said, and this was the first time a pig made a monkey of an evolutionist. I like that. Dr. Dwayne Gish. Then we had the Piltdown Man hoax in 1912. And by the way, these hoaxes are somewhat understandable because they came on the heels of the popularized evolutionary theory. And the scientific community, the people that bought into this ideology, needed something to support their viewpoint. And so they saw things that didn't exist. I think there are still hoaxes going on, but it's probably a little more careful because it's hard to pull off a hoax these days because of the technological advances that exist. Okay, we're going to talk about Lucy in a little bit here, but right now we're going to talk about that she and her fellow Hadar inhabitants may have been champies. Now, that may be kind of small for you to read, so I'll just read it for you. But they must be something closely related to them. Evolutionists believe our descent from Lucy took about 3 million years and 5 million mutations. I don't think that's quite enough. Time or mutations. Thinking how many cells we have in our body, they're into the trillions. In some ways, the Lucy saga takes on the flavor of the Piltdown Man hoax. Charles Dawson, and an unknown accomplice, the possible Pierre Teilhard de Chardin, perpetrated this hoax between 1908 and 1915. 1953, see how many more years later. After more than 500 doctoral dissertations had been written up on Piltdown, the hoax was discovered. A fraud that did much to establish the veracity of evolution in the minds of men and destroyed the hope of faith in Jesus Christ for many. I'm reading. I didn't make this up here. Sir Arthur Keith, a great anatomist and the most prolific Piltdown author, kept his faith in Piltdown, although he often felt on the verge of conversion to Jesus Christ during his visits to evangelistic meetings. However, because he believed the Genesis account of creation was a myth, he rejected the gospel and never realized the great assurances of hope we have in Christ. So these factors do affect people. I'm still a Calvinist. Just got to say, they're out there confusing people. Now we have Lucy. Lucy, I think I was going to forgot to bring you a map, but it's on the. She was found. I say she because that's the name they give her. Give it her. On the eastern edge of Africa. What is that? Saw the Dead Sea. Red Sea goes through there. I showed you earlier about they wanted to build a bridge over into Saudi Arabia. Well, it's in that area on the eastern, western side of that spring, of that bridge, is where this is. It's called a triangle. I forget what the name of the triangle is. All right. So Lucy, consisting of a skeleton, 40% complete. And by the way, you see her here. The orange parts are the parts they found. Or I should say put together. It was discovered in Ethiopia by Donald Johansson in 1974 and was dated to be 3.2 million years of age. He calculated her to have stood about 3.5 feet tall and weighed about 50 pounds. Certain features suggested to Johansson that it may have been, that it may have walked erect and therefore evolving into a human. This walking erect was the key issue here, and was somewhat that walking on all fours to walking on two, we're heading the direction from monkey to man. So this becomes really, really exciting for these guys who are still looking for the missing link. Now, Lucy is not a ape human intermediate, but rather an extinct species of an ape which probably spent most of its time in the trees. Now here, I don't know, these are probably not the actual bones, it's probably a makeup of it, but these are the bones that were found, where Lucy in Ethiopia, okay? So again, we see it more complete here, but when you see it like this, you see, wow, there's a lot missing there, isn't there? So let's look at some of the features of Lucy, which are important in this study. Everyone agrees that from the neck up, Lucy was gorilla-like. Her brain size was about 1/4 the size of a human brain. Her jaw was U-shaped, typical of gorillas. Her teeth were large, far larger than those in humans. From the neck down, nearly every feature was likewise non-human. I'm not going to try to pronounce these Latin names. Pithecus is the last part of it. These fossils, including those which are thought to be much more recent and therefore should be more human-like, have long, curved fingers, long, curved toes, well adapted to swinging from the tree limb to tree limb. Now, we don't see any of those feet bones showing here. The features which suggest upright posture to Johnson are primarily hip and knee joints, with numerous studies of the hip have shown, but numerous studies of the hip have shown otherwise. Oxnard, in his 1987 book, Fossil Teeth and Sex, well, that's an interesting title, claims that these fossils clearly differ from more than both humans and African apes than do those living groups from each other. All right, so much for that. Moving on. Evidently, these Lucy could walk somewhat upright, this argument goes, as pygmy chimps do today, but not in the human manner at all. Furthermore, get this, furthermore, Johansson seldom reminds us that he found the knee joint, which he is building his hypothesis on, the strongest evidence for upright stance in a location some 2 to 3 kilometers, that's over a mile, away and in a layer of rock some 200 feet lower. Clearly doesn't mention that often. Clearly the knee does not belong with the rest. But even if they do go together, the knee is not diagnostically upright and points more specifically to tree climbing abilities, according to Oxnard and other authorities. And I can't get into details with you on this. I'm just reading what I have read. So we have hoax after hoax. But who remembers that they are hoaxes? You go from Lucy to Heidelberg, Nebraska, the Piltdown Man, the Peking Man. I think Lucy is kind of the last one on board here. So, but the people are affected by these things. So blindly committed to the uniformitarian model, the process is to find things and then put them on the scale where you think they should be. And lo and behold, you go from monkey to man. I came across this day that Science Channel had the top 10 hoaxes. Number one, the Piltdown Man hoax is a jaw of a monkey. The whole thing started in 1912 when Charles Dawson claimed to find some interesting bones in the gravel pit. We talk about Piltdown Man a little bit. I want to give more detail. And Science Channel thinks this is the number one hoax. The paleontologists at the British Museum assembled the bones and believed that they represented a missing link between the humans and apes. 40 years later, I think it was a high school student looked at that and said, that looks like an ape's jaw. And it ended up being true. 40 years later, scientists proved that the Piltdown Man was a deliberate attempt at paleontological fraud. Well, what part of this skull here do you think is real? Dark or light? The dark. The light's been supposed. Supposed. Number two. Archaeoraptor, probably. 1999, National Geographic described this creature as the missing link. This is 1999. Between dinosaur and birds. Yeah, not so much. Turns out that the fossil found in China was actually a forgery constructed of rearranged pieces of real fossils from different species. That's number two. So the top two are frauds in the paleontology realm. Science cannot lie, but scientists can. So the point of all this is to point out the unreliability of the scientific community that is committed to the evolutionary models of origins. They need a missing link, desperately. And we say, well, they need a lot more than one missing link, but truly they need millions and billions and trillions, but they need the first one to get to number two, right? So if they can't get number one, they'll never get number two. So that's why they work on number one. But even if if they find number one, I don't know what, it would have to be a fraud. It would have to be a fraud. Just out of hand, it'd have to be a fraud. So the hoaxes, is that how you spell that? I could figure out. Is that supposed to be ES? Come on, you English people, tell me. Hoaxes? Anyway, I'm going to say hoaxes. Continue. The Neanderthal man discussed later is the current hope for providing the missing link. The man-like ape or the ape-like man, whichever you like. There have been partial skulls, missing jaws that have been reconstructed to resemble the missing link. But DNA kind of crops up here a little bit. The decoding challenge has challenged this solution as a missing link, and now we have disagreement about what their model really is going to be like. Although only a small part of the Neanderthal DNA has been decoded, there is enough for the pickers and the choosers to decide that the Neanderthal is not human, thus a missing link, a hominid. I never could say that word. Yet the DNA studies show some agreement with human DNA coding, which is true for a lot of animals between humans. They now assume that there was interbreeding. Oh, new idea. Between man and the Neanderthal, not all agree on this assumption. I, for one, you can't have humans breeding with non-humans. In every other species on the earth, when that happens, they're sterile. You know, so we're going to have this, you know, idea. Oh, goes on. This seems a little problematic for the Neanderthals if they were predecessors to man. I'm not sure how to draw this on the board, so I tried this. Okay, so here we have monkeys. That's where we started. Actually, we started over there. But we got up to monkeys. The monkeys went into the Neanderthals, and then they died out, which really bothers me. If any animal is going to die out, it's going to be a sheep. It's defenseless. It needs a man to make it live, you know? So, why does Neanderthal die out? He's got brains. He's smarter than the average, more smarter than the average animal. But he's conveniently dies out because they don't need him anymore. So I don't know why he dies out. Well, he's not here. That's why he died out. Well, maybe he never existed. Be a better answer. So we have Neanderthal somehow dies out. But before he dies out, he breeds with man. And we'll give you a little bit head start what we're doing here. Breeds with man, and out of this produces basically two groups of people. Seems to be like a whole lot better thing. Let's start with Adam and Eve, coast down time, and we find these Neanderthal type people, which is basically ancient man, and let it go at that. No, we have to have the evolutionary thought involved in here. And, you know, this stuff believers can get caught up in. You think, no, they don't, but they do. Okay. Let's see. Now, this whole idea about time. So we have to have, now all of a sudden, we have Neanderthals come along. I never know how this transition happens. They come along like this, and then we jump, and now we have man. I said, what happens in this section right there? You know, so all the while, they had overlap. You know, they had overlap. You just can't have one all of a sudden jump. I mean, so there had to be some overlap. Well, then when you have overlap, you've got both. Well, if you have both, then they interbreed, so we have this. It just never makes any sense to me how this really worked out. So we have some flexible time scales. They put this back farther, and then all of a sudden you got Neanderthals up to here, the humans started here. But wait a minute, they lived before it, so all of a sudden the time scales, you know, overlap. But that's not a problem for the Darwinist, because, get rid of that little thing, because the time scales are flexible. So they can just slide them back and forth, whatever they need. So here we have our little progression. Here's the Neanderthal man, then we have the Homo sapiens, which supposedly represents us. Shows my little diagram on the board. Neanderthal, he dies out. Somehow modern man, I don't know where he came from. I thought he came from Neanderthal. You know, so all of a sudden he's out of nowhere, and he breeds with him. So we have this crossbreeding, and now these are called the Europeans. And the modern man are now as Africans, because somehow they see differences in these DNAs. I'm confused. You know, one place he says, and I'll talk about this, one place he said the DNA coding has been done. Next place, it's only partially done. Well, it's partially done, but but we can bridge the gaps. You start talking things like this, you sort of think, do they really have any idea what the DNA looks like? So a better solution is man with common distinctions. You know, some of us are tall, some are short, blonde, some of us are redheads, some of us are whatever. You know, we're all human. And we really are all one race, no matter what color we happen to come out as. Okay. So there's no interbreeding. Now some say no. The biologists in Leipzig, Germany, having slowly reconstructed the genome of the genome, you know, that's the gene stuff, you know, the genes and chromosomes, it makes one word, all that. Genome of the Neanderthals, the stocky hunters that dominated Europe until 30,000 years ago, by extracting the fragments of DNA that still exists in the fossil bones. Just last year, when the biologists first announced that they had decoded the Neanderthal genome, I'm thinking they did all of it. No, they just did part of it. They reported no significant evidence of interbreeding. So they are separate. Well, the guy said, no, they've been, what chance is it? So let's talk about the Neanderthal. First found in the Neander Valley. By the way, I guess the Neander was a hymn writer. I don't know that. Maybe we can look at our hymn books, see if we can find a man who wrote hymns. It's in the Neander Valley in Germany, near Dusseldorf in 1856. Only the head bone was found, plus some other bones around. They didn't have the characteristic or purposeful burial that others have been observed to have had. There are fewer than 500 of these found in any part counts as a whole, by the way. Now, think about this. After 200,000 years, according to these guys, 200,000 years of living, only these few have been discovered. You know, 200,000 years of humanity or Neanderthal bones, there got to be a few more. Suppose the rate of growth, which we have in our recent lessons, the rate of 1.3% growth per year, that brings us about 7 billion people in 1,600 years up to the flood. 50 generations, but they suppose 200,000 years, which is 10,000 generations, and that would be a 20 years generation, might be a little bit young. That puts you at 10 times 8,600 power, which is a number you can't even imagine what that number is. It's so big. And yet we only find 500 fossils. Maybe they're wrong about their dating by that count alone. So we look at fossils, bones, we see things like this. I just put this up because, however you say that name, Vinja in Croatia is where another site for these Neanderthals. All right. Now, this is Ewan Calloway, not a believer for what I can tell, just thought you might see what he would say about the Neanderthal. He says they are closely related to us, or they are closely related to, they are so closely related that some researchers group them and us as a single species. Now we're getting close. I would see them as a form of humans that are a bit more different from humans are than humans are today, but not much. So on and so on and so forth from Lipsick, whose team sequenced the Neanderthal genome. The common ancestors of humans and Neanderthals live in Africa about 500,000 years ago. After that, the ancestors of the Neanderthals moved north and eventually made it to Europe and Asia. Our ancestors, meanwhile, stuck around Africa until 10,000 years ago before eventually conquering the globe. Neanderthals died out around 28,000 years ago. Well, they lived quite a while. He goes on to say, how did they get this genome out of the Neanderthal bone? The bone, look at the slope of the looseness of what how they did this. Bone contains DNA that survived long after an animal dies. Over time, though, strands of DNA break up and microbes with their own DNA invade the bone. Pablo's team found ways around both problems with these 38,000, 44,000-year-old bones covered in Croatia. They used a DNA sequencing machine that rapidly decodes short strands and came up with ways to get rid of the microbial contamination. I have to take the word for it. They ended up with the short stretches of DNA code that computer stitched into more complex or complete sequences. Bothered by that a little bit? Stitch things together? Maybe they can do this. Where's Marty? Are you here tonight? I need some DNA guys. This process isn't perfect. Well, there we have it right there. They admitted it. Pablo's team decoded about 5.3 billion letters of Neanderthal DNA. Much of this is duplicates because assuming it's the same size as the human genome, the actual Neanderthal genome is only about 3 billion letters long. So they got about twice as much as they need because of duplication. More than a third of the genome remains unsequenced. See, now we have some done and some not done, but we've made our conclusions already. But he's so happy about it, he used profanity here. It's pretty good for something that 38,000 years old. All right, so that's the basis for their conclusion. Well, what did they find? Any human whose ancestral group developed outside of Africa has little Neanderthal in them, between 1 and 4% of their genome, Pablo's team estimates. In other words, humans and Neanderthals have had sex and had hybrid offspring. Here's that other theory. A small amount of that genetic mingling survives in the non-Africans today. Neanderthals didn't live in Africa, which is why Sub-Saharan African population have no trace of Neanderthal DNA. I have no idea about that stuff, but that's how they explain this stuff. Now, this mixing together, it's impossible to know how often humans invited Neanderthals back to their caves and vice versa, but the genome data offers some intriguing details. So that's the detail of interbreeding here, option. Well, it must have been at least 45,000 years ago, a geneticist at Harvard School who was involved in the project. That's because all non-Africans, be they from France, China, Papua New Guinea, share the same amount of DNA, Neanderthal DNA, suggests that interbreeding occurred before these populations. The timing makes the Middle East the likeliest place where these humans leaving Africa and resident Neanderthals did this interbreeding thing. This is on a blog site, and I read down, and this guy responded to this guy's stuff. And finally, I came to this one. This guy says about what he just read, what you just heard. It's fun to speculate wildly about without bothering with evidence. And he was probably sympathetic to what the guy was saying, but he recognized the guy was really out on a limb speculating. And he said, it's fun to speculate without evidence. I saw a moment of frivolity, a ton of truth. All right, are you here, Kurt? I saw you walk in. This is for you. This is a dentist dream. So help me. Do you know about this book? Pretty Live? You'd be the only guy in this room that could understand it. He talks dental talk. Now, Jack Cuzzo, how do you say that? How do you say pizza? Don't you put a T in front of the Z's, an Italian word? So it'd be Cuzzo. He's Italian. Buried Alive. We have it over in the Strong Words bookstore. At least we did. That's where I got it. Twilight has some amazing stuff back there sometime. I don't know where she gets it from. Or the Lord just puts it down because I need it. I don't know. Both probably. All right. Written by an orthodontist who lived the life of Indiana Jones. Running from French museums, being followed by men, being chased by high-speed sports cars, being shot at, he thinks. He was shot at. Doesn't know whether it was personal or whether it was a stray bullet, but he was shot at. Barricading himself in with his family in hotel rooms, being followed by spies, because he had x-rayed Neanderthal skulls to study the originals rather than the plaster casts. I'll tell you the story. He, to his surprise, found that some of them had been altered to change their appearance to make them look like pre-human hominids or Neanderthals. The first half of the book reads like Indiana Jones. And the last half, Kurt, where are you? Explain this stuff to me. Because we're talking about Neanderthal. He's talking about the head and the jaw and the teeth and how they fit together. Who else would know this stuff? So Jack Cuzzo, in 1976, had become leery of some of the Neanderthal claims of paleontologists and wanted to examine the skulls written up in the journals for himself. His friend, Dr. Krogman, PhD, by the way, small print here says, who had forensically examined Hitler's burned remains in Berlin, 1945. Isn't that interesting? He personally actually did it. And he had it there, he finished his work, left it there, went to bed. In the morning, the Russians came in and took it all. And the Americans objected to it, but what are you going to do? They're Russians, and they took it. And probably had to take it back to Stalin and make sure that Hitler was dead. So Krogman did the forensic work on it. Well, anyway, this guy had written letters of introduction to the directors of research in Paris, and you have the name of the place. I guess kind of museum. He borrowed a 350-pound portable x-ray machine from Dr. Brown, who had x-rayed heads in South America. He needed a special machine that to avoid distortion and the mount. It had to be a machine to measure heads, you know, x-ray heads. And he had done this in Africa. So he got to borrow this machine, 300-pound, and he went down to Paris with it, with his whole family. In Paris, he began to examine the national treasures of France, sought after by Hitler to support his superior race theories. Cuzzo had access to the cabinet where these skulls were kept, and I'm giving you how he got it, but how he got there is really amazing. The whole thing is like God just opened the doors and just made it happen. I mean, just amazing. So, again, the front part of the book is very interesting to read. Cuzzo had access to the cabinet where these skulls were kept. One of these was the published skull of a young child. You can say it in French, Petit de Lazé. This fossil was described in the catalog of fossil hominids. Cuzzo had a personal copy of the book, and in it was a description of the skulls that he had in his hands. This was described as a Neanderthal child accompanied by a drawing and not a photograph. Well, that is small. Can you read that back there? Well, good for you. I can't read it over here. It's small on my thing here. This book was remarkable because of what it contained. It was on page 270 that I saw, he quotes, I'm quoting him, I saw something that just about shocked me to the foundation of my being. There on that page, in black and white, was an article about the little Neanderthal child that was sitting on the lab bench right in front of me. This was no coincidence. I think he's saying God is in this. It was totally in French and written by Pathé of Poitiers, France. In the next page, there was an illustration of this skull with what appeared to be its lower jaw out of joint. This was not a photograph. It was a drawing. Nevertheless, it was supposed to represent the real relationship of the lower jaw to the upper jaw and to the skull. So why did this upset me so much? When I picked up the Petit de Lazay skull in my hands and carefully placed the lower teeth against the upper teeth, it, in what we orthodontists call a centric occlusion, I'm not going to read what that is, but they fit. I did this over and over, 3, 4, 5 times, and each time the jaw, what was the word, condyles? How do you say that? Can you see that word? Condyles. All right, that's a long I. Condyles. It fits together perfectly with the sockets when the teeth were in its maximum concentric occlusion position. I guess like when you close your mouth, right? When you close your mouth. They fit. You know, no dickering. I'm going to the dentist tomorrow. I can hardly wait. I've had a loose cap for 3 weeks. If it comes off, you know, give it back. All right. Well, it didn't look like the drawing at all. Well, I thought maybe there was a good reason for this. I checked what Pathé had to say in his description of the text in the article. He said, in this translation, when the teeth are placed in the occlusion or contact, condyle does not fit properly or articulate with the socket in the cranium or skull, but it really did fit with the teeth in the normal occlusion, normal contact position. Oh, we're going to see this in a minute here, so hang on. With great trepidation, I first checked the real photos of the patch in the illustration in the book, in the Neanderthal Sanitary book. They matched exactly, only it didn't show the lower and upper jaw together with the teeth in contact. Besides that, the name Petit de Lazay was written on the right side of the skull that I had in my hands. There was no mistaking it. This actually was the Petit child. However, this was a new, non-ape-like position of the lower jaw. For a moment, my mind was unable to entirely comprehend what I was really observing. I thought back to my agreement with Dr. Coupins concerning the handling of the delicate x-ray equipment when the project was complete. I knew that if I placed the lower jaw where it should be, that it would be a major clash with E. Pathé's construction of an evolutionary theory. Took away their missing link. If I took my radiographs in the new and correct position because the teeth fit together perfectly, this would be a shock for everyone in the Department of Human Paleontology in France, eventually in the whole world. I did what I had to do. I took all the pictures and the radiographs in the new anatomically correct real position. And it's after this is when his trouble in Paris starts happening, when he gets chased and all this other stuff. He gets followed. Okay. Now, on the right here is the way it was drawn in the book. As a Neanderthal child. You see the joint. This should be there, right, Kurt? This should be there. And that tips this out, the bottom of the face, the top tips out. Now, this is a drawing, so you can just fudge a little bit on this. So this looks like it really fits together very, very well. But this is the picture of the actual face, and look how much different it looks. With the joint back in its right place, the teeth fit together perfectly, the jaw comes back, the head goes forward, you know, instead of sliding back. And I drew these lines. See, here is the new way, which would be more human. And this is the monkey way, more slanted out, with the teeth out forward. So this has been faked. And that's what he saw. Now what do I do? He said, do I show it the way it is and bring the wrath of everybody down on me? Or do I, you know, go along with the gag. Well, of course, he was down there to know the truth, so he took the pictures. So you understand what we're seeing here, everybody? Okay. Now, that yellow line says it all. I mean, it's the way the face is. And moving that jaw forward just distorts it and doesn't make it look like makes it look like a monkey. Monkey-like. And that's what we have with these Neanderthals. They're monkey-like. They're not total monkeys. So you just have to get something that looks like a monkey, and you'll be happy with that. Okay. I don't want to go on. Now, here's another one. I'm not going to read the small stuff for you, but the same thing happened on this one here. Another adjustment, and you see the difference, the way this looks and the teeth, how far out they are. And the socket, again, is out of joint here. And so that means this top head is tipped out, you know, because these are breaks here, you see. And you put them back where it should be, then all of a sudden you have a pretty much normal human face or human skull. Another adjustment. Well, what is Neanderthal man? Well, if we mean part ape man, part ape, part man, there's no such thing. There is doctoring of fossils to make such pre-human creatures exist, and they are necessary for the evolution to have credibility. I mean, it destroys their credibility when you do this. But for the time being, unless it's discovered, you know, it gives us some credibility. It's kind of like you never want to be discovered while you're alive. If you're dead, that's okay. It's kind of like the national debt. I don't want to be responsible for dealing with it. I just don't want to be caught with it in my term. So they put these things off, knowing that there someday somebody's going to catch up with them. But for now, we're playing the game. So if there is no evidence, no evidence exists, we have to manufacture it or simply speculate, like the guy says, for the fun of it. And I said before, there can be no interbreeding or crossbreeding of these entities if they're not the same. I don't think there's ever been a human that would be wrong, but interbred with any other animal. There has never occurred. So all of a sudden, we have it happening back here. Not likely. Well, we simply have a man for whom Christ died. Let's get it down to that level. It's a human being. Some of them have characteristics of long lives lived. Here again, Kuso is really helpful because he understands the head. He studied this. You read this stuff. Kuso says that for those who have lived long lives, stop here, I'm going to show you the chart. Remember how this goes before the flood and after the flood? This is after the flood. We have these guys here outlive their children, not by 10 or 20 years, by 150 years. So these, like, I forget who this guy's name is. Arpachshad, whatever. These are names in the line of the descendants to Abraham. They lived 438 years, 433, 464, 239. You see they go down. But when somebody lives that long, Kutso says things happen to them. You know, facially, how they look. And I'm going to go back. Kutso says that for those who live long lives, their face grows forward, and if they also chewed moderate to heavy foods, the eye sockets develop brows. This affects the facial bones moving forward, dropping as the bones absorb hundreds of years of intermittent or constant chewing forces. And I've been told the jaw is the strongest muscle in the head, or in the body, is what I'm trying to say. And so you chew down on stuff that's not cooked very well, you know, meat, you know, these muscles pull your face down. Is that right? Okay, so this starts having, now this doesn't just go on for a guy like me, 73 years, this goes on for people that live 400 years. And for 400 years they're doing this, they're chewing, the bones are sagging, the brows are getting heavier and heavier. So this affects the chewing facial bones moving forward and dropping the bones. They absorb hundreds of years of intermittent chewing. Typical of men, women of very old age, I guess I'm going to have to start watching old people, because they do have some characteristics that make them look old. What is it that makes us look old? Our family always has a strong brow here. I suppose this is going to start coming out now. Typical of men and women of very old age, they had large brows, ridges over their eyes. See this guy here? Sticker said that this buildup of bone over the eye sockets must be interpreted as a forward shift of the masticatory anchorage. That's in other words, the muscles are anchored to your bones. In response to the pronounced facial prognathius in primitive human races. Masticatory anchorage means the. I'm getting so frustrated reading these words. You know, when I was in architecture, we talked human language. We had 2x4s, we had bags of cement, but you get this stuff, and I decided why that is. Because the people that had to do the work we designed just used normal language. You know, if you're a doctor, everybody in the operating room uses the same language. You don't have to communicate with the uneducated. But we had to communicate with uneducated as well. So we use normal words like 2x4s, but not when you're this kind of guy. So these masticatory anchorage means bones supporting the chewing forces. Facial prognathism means the forward position of the face in the head. All right, so now we have people of a long time. We're going to expect that they're going to look different than we look. We did this already. The ancestors outlived their descendants. All of these could have taken on the characteristics of Neanderthal man. And by the way, there were more than just these. These are just the line of down to Abraham. There were across, you know, there are hundreds, there had to be thousands, tens of thousands of these people that lived these long ages, these early days after the flood. Old men with facial bones, facial bone changes that make them have pronounced bone structure. Sagging facial bones all perhaps resemble something as an ape-like figure, yet were fully human. Most Neanderthals were buried with ritual burial. Now, this is an example that these are not animals. I don't know if any animals bury their dead. So when humans bury the dead, I should say, when these animals bury the dead, you got to think they're humans. Not only do they bury the dead, they have rituals with the death, because these Neanderthals, many of them are marked with a red ochre. Now, I guess they probably have to guess a little bit why they're doing this, but red ochre is red, and this is found on the body and on the bones, so apparently it's been covered with this material, which would indicate they believe something about an afterlife, because blood is red, blood is life. So putting this red ochre on these bodies would probably indicate that there was some hope that they would be back to life someday. So they lived as far west as Gibraltar, as far as east as China, north to Belgium, Germany, and South Africa, although I don't usually see them way down South Africa. They are not cave dwellers. They're not Stone Age people. Although, if you were caught out in the wild someplace and you had no tools, you might pick up a stone, wouldn't you? So there were probably people after the flood had to start over. Everything was destroyed. So they, in a sense, had to go back to live like Stone Age people. But they weren't Stone Age people at all. There never was such a thing as Stone Age. Remember, we don't believe in the progress. We believe in the decline. So these were not cave dwellers as first beings. Because they're not first beings. We've got Noah's flood. First beings are back here. And by the way, somebody gave me an article. I'd like to know who it was. They put me in a box about the DNA from mothers and fathers. Did anybody do that here? It's a great article. Great article. In fact, I got to use it sometime. It just proves everything the Bible says about our ancestry, about Adam and Eve. We'll talk about it now. I just thought maybe I'd ask about that. It was a great article. So we'll fix that at work and in sometime. All right. So these are not cave dwellers as we think about Stone Age cave dwellers. They were there because they probably lived there because they needed a place to live. So we can summarize the Neanderthal man, also known as the ancient man, not a Stone Age man. The fossils are more likely post-flood human beings, simply. They look like primary beings, but they were not, since they were descendants of the Noahic family. They may have utilized caves for protection from elements. They consciously buried their dead with some hope of afterlife, the red ochre. The appearance was as a result of a long life, sagging facial bones, raised brows due to heavy mastication, that's chewing. Bone growth continues into the old age. I always knew the cartilages did, like your ears get bigger, nose gets longer. But he says, Cuso says, that your head size grows big. He says, you ever try, you still wearing the same head size you did when you were a kid? When you were a young man? Try it out. So bones keep on growing. If you grow for another 300 years, we don't know how big the head may get. Having been found all in the European Asian continents, our hemisphere seems too far for these people in the post-flood to have ventured. At least so far, there's none been found here. According to Cuso, these early humans lived long, matured later, and aged slowly. And he spends quite a bit of time about the maturing process. I didn't realize this, and you look at a couple of things to determine this. Was it the onset of menses for women has come down greatly in the last 200 years? I got to read about why they think that is. But he says it's just part of the descent. And so these people, back we have records of when they started, and so we know that that has happened. So his argument is that girls, boys, change of voice, would have been later, years later than we have now. So we have a slower maturing process and also a very slowing aging process that gives us these longevities of people. That's another subject which we won't deal with because, to some extent, fairly speculative. It is 8 o'clock. Are there questions or comments? And next week, we're going to do the beginning of the ark stuff.
Would it be possible they would find more human skeleton stuff? They went under the 1,000-foot crust?
Well, that'd be a guess. No one's digging that deep. The best you have is you have people that drill for water and oil and dig up things like that down there. Yes, there'd be pieces of. So the Neanderthal man that lives next to you is really human after all. The last hope. So when the Neanderthal dies, which he will eventually, he will die. All truth will prevail. So we'll have to come with another thing. All right, you're satisfied and we'll let you go home. Thanks for coming tonight. I'll pray. Lord, thank you for the evening. Lord, again, we are appreciative of the simplicity of the Scripture. And as I thought about it today, there is nothing in Scripture that is not attacked by the humanists these days. There is nothing sacred. And so when it comes to our origins, you've been very clear about that. You've made us as we are, and we are wonderfully made, and we live in a wonderfully made universe, although now under the curse. So when we read and study these suggested ideas of humanity and how we came to be, we smile, but we also are grieved by the blindness and the arrogance of humanity that's raised up against you. So Lord, we somewhat participate in that as well, because those that take a view of the Scriptures as the literal Word of God are often maligned and disdained and made fun of. But Lord, that's a privilege we have to suffer on your behalf. Even in our country, Lord, it's not really that bad. But we know across the world that it is serious, especially in places where there is less Christianity demonstrated as we have here in the United States. Thank you, Lord, for our evening together. Bless our families. Take us home. Keep us safe. Bring us back next week. And Lord, keep this church faithful to the word as we grow and live in it. And for the friends we have here, we thank you so very much. In Jesus' name I pray it. Amen.